Hello and welcome to this pilot episode, this very first episode of Democracy In. And this week we are talking about democracy in the United Kingdom. I am joined by two fabulous guests, Nicola Sherratt and John Layton. As you may have guessed, John Layton is my brother. He is related to me. He has lots of opinions. Everybody in my family has lots of opinions. John particularly has lots of opinions. But I am really happy that he's going to be sharing them with us. He has a lot of really great on-the-ground knowledge about what is happening in the UK right now. How do people feel about things like the hell is happening in the Conservative Party? Many of you from other parts of the world have probably heard about or seen pictures of Boris Johnson. We will be spending a lot of time in this podcast talking about what on earth is up with Boris Johnson. My second guest is Nicola Sherratt. Nicola is a fantastic anthropology professor. She has joint citizenship between the UK and the US. She grew up in the UK with a mother from the US, and she came to live here in Chicago in her early 20s and has lived here the rest of her life. However, she obviously has maintained strong connections with the UK. So she has a really interesting perspective. Another thing that's really interesting about the conversation we have here with Nicola in particular is that Nicola is currently based in Atlanta, in Georgia, which those of you who are familiar with what is happening in the US right now will understand that she is currently right in the epicenter of some of the really big, frightening challenges to the US democratic system. So she is going to bring that perspective. She also has experience of traveling around the world. She's worked in Peru specifically for many, many years. So I am really excited to introduce these two guests and get this conversation started. In this very first episode, we are going to be spending quite a bit of time talking about how do we feel about the Queen? Theoretically, our democracy is headed by somebody who just inherits that title. What do we feel about the role of the royal family and the Houses of Lords as well, which doesn't get quite so much attention as the Queen does because they're not quite as glamorous as people like Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. But they are also part of this unelected system of government that we have in the UK, which might seem a little strange in this day and age. In the second episode, we're going to be getting into some more of the tricky philosophical questions. Things like, what does it mean to have a scandal in the UK? What does it mean to trust your government or not trust your government? Who do we think the government actually works for? And is it possible to make change? Also, what I'm really excited about in our second episode is we start talking about what are the other aspects of a democracy that maybe aren't so obvious. So, I will not give away any more spoilers. Let's dig in. Hello and welcome to our pilot episode, our very first episode of This Is What Democracy Looks Like in the United Kingdom. Today we're going to start with the UK, where I am from. And welcome to my two lovely guests, Nicola Sherratt and John Layton. I'm going to give you guys a chance to introduce yourselves. So, John, tell us who you are, where you're from, what you do, stuff like that.
Hi, I'm John Layton. You might guess from the surname, but I'm Mary's brother. So known her for a very long time. And I'm a finance director for a tech company. I'm based in Cambridge in the UK, which is one of the more liberal and kind of affluent parts of the country. But as well as being a very affluent country, a part of the country, it's also one of the most economically divided. So the disparity between poverty and wealth in Cambridge is pretty much one of the highest in the country, which makes it very interesting.
I didn't know that, But John, just very quickly, because we're talking about the UK, and I know you're my brother, but still, tell me, what would you define your class background as? Because I feel that's something that's completely relevant when people talk
about it. So I think this is an interesting one. So actually,
If you looked
at our parents started off as probably, you know, low middle class, maybe working class. But then both Mary and myself went to private public schools and boarding schools, which means most people would probably consider us, you know, upper middle class. And certainly if you looked at my job as well and the sort of things I do, I would definitely consider myself upper middle class. Definitely not upper class, sorry, because I've might have gone to a posh school, but I wasn't posh. So
Right, yeah.
you really need to be British to understand the distinctions between these various
I
layers as you
know,
go up.
right? Yeah. Well, this is what I think is really interesting because I think, we can't have a conversation about anything about the UK without talking about class. But and I think one of the things that's important here that you're pointing out is that British people are really aware of all the fine-grained, like every time you open your mouth, people are making a judgment about your class background. And John, I think your perspective is going to be interesting because you have been like the biggest social mobility, I think, in our family, from like our parents who are a builder and a housewife to working in, well, you're a banker, right? You work in finance. So yeah, thank you for that. And your pronouns are he, him.
Hey,
Yes, thank you very much. Okay, Nikki, I'm going to ask you the same question. First of all, do you want to be called Nicola, Nikki, or Nick?
really don't mind.
Okay,
So
fair enough.
whatever you prefer, whatever comes, at the moment is
Professor
fine.
Charlotte, please introduce
Let's not do that.
yourself.
So I am Nicola Sharrett, or Nikki, or Nick. I am not related to Mary by blood, but I have known her for a really long time.
Yeah.
Not quite 20 years, but getting there,
At
I
least,
think.
yeah.
Yeah, a long
Yeah.
time, a
Yeah,
really long
a
time.
long time. Yeah.
My pronouns are she, her, hers. I grew up in Kent, in Canterbury, which is quite an affluent part of the southeast of England. I now live in Atlanta, in Georgia, in the US. But anybody who follows the current travails of US politics, I
Yes.
live and vote in Fulton County, which is at the heart of all the post January 6th
Oh my
crises that
goodness.
we are living through.
Yeah.
So I vote a lot. I no longer, I've lived long enough now that I no longer have a vote in the UK
You mean
currently.
you lived out of the UK long enough?
Out of the UK, sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
I've lived out of the UK so long now, 18 years, that I no longer currently have. But
Yeah.
I do vote still in the US. I would definitely describe myself as solidly middle class.
In both
Probably
the
on both sides of the Atlantic.
Yeah, I was gonna say, would you see yourself as solidly middle class in the UK and in the US?
I would say I solidly grew up middle class in the UK. My
Yeah.
dad's family is from a working class background, and my dad went on, got a PhD, and kind of the social mobility that we talked about with John. But I grew up in a part of the UK where there was still the 11 plus test and grammar school. So I went to state school, but I went to selective single sex state school.
So the 11 plus is it was quite controversial. It was like an exam you took when you were 11 years old, and it made the decision whether you were going to go to a comprehensive school, which is like for everybody, i.e., it was meant to be for people who are not academic, or you went to a grammar school, which was the like academic school. So it's like a way of dividing people up at the age of 11. Yeah.
Definitely. And lots of conflicted feelings about that now.
Yeah,
From an
yeah.
individual standpoint, it kind of definitely set me on a course that I continued on. I didn't mention it earlier, but I am an archaeologist, so I teach anthropology and archaeology. I would also describe myself as middle class here. Though with inflation and stuff, I feel like that it's a shifting metric right
Interesting.
now and
Yeah.
so forth. But I think by most metrics, I would put myself very solidly middle.
Yeah, so you're a professor in Georgia,
Yes.
and well, obviously you've lived in both the US and the UK, and I know you have joint citizenship, right? Yeah, but you've lived other places as well. Tell me,
I have. So
tell us where else you've lived.
I spend quite extended periods of time in Andean South America, mostly in Peru. The most extended of those periods has been 6 months at a time. So I've never been legally resident in a third country, but I certainly have spent, periods that I would describe as living there.
Yeah.
And to the extent possible, keep up with those third sets of politics as well. So I feel myself kind of like I know a little bit about three places politically,
Yes. Yeah,
and
yeah.
have voted in two of those three places.
Have you ever seen an election take place in Peru?
I've been there a number of times for presidential elections. And actually, I just had to meet a mayoral candidate. Like, I was there a couple of weeks ago. A guy who was running for mayor of the city that I work in, which was a very bizarre experience. We were invited to this lunch to talk to him about heritage and stuff.
So it sounds like you do have points of triangulation. Mm-hmm. You can see a comparison. Yeah, that's really interesting. Have you always voted in every election?
Yes, I did not vote in the runoff yesterday in Georgia. That's the one.
Oh, right.
But normally, because there wasn't many left in the Democrat side. But yeah, I'm normally very committed to voting.
Yeah.
I've voted in every national local election I can, apart from one. And in that election, the parties I didn't like did very, very well, which is my thing for. And it was one of these apathy things where all the people like me couldn't be bothered voting. The parties I particularly disliked did very well. So ever since then, it's just rain or shine, I go out. Well, actually, now I sign up for postal vote because it's easier.
Right. And when I was able to carry on voting in the UK, because like Nicola, I have gone past the 15 years mark now, so I can't vote in the UK anymore. When I was still able to vote in the UK, you, John, were my proxy voter. Yeah. So you voted for me. Yeah.
Yeah, I had my dad as my proxy vote.
Yeah.
I gave up on the postal stuff because there was one year a few years ago where they sent them out too late for everyone to get them back in time. And that made me really nervous. And now I won't even do postal voting here in the US because I don't trust it, which is like sounds really cynical. But that one bad experience, I switched to proxy vote.
Yeah. So you have one bad experience in one country and then you.
Yeah. And my friends who can't understand it, they keep trying to tell me to like do early voting. I'm like, no, I would rather go do it in person early voting than trust it be mail. And here, you know, it's a whole big thing about mail-in ballots and stuff here. I feel like I should trust it, but because of that experience in the UK, I can't bring myself to trust it.
Yeah. I mean, there's the whole question of like, how do you trust the methods of voting? So maybe we could think about that a little bit. So how do you cast a vote in the UK?
Generally, it's you turn up at your polling booth, you put the cross in your box, you drop it in. There isn't the early voting like you have in the US. Mm-hmm. It's on the day. If you want to vote early, you have to do a postal vote. You can also do proxy votes like I did for Mary. Mm-hmm. You have to trust the person because actually Mary asked me to vote for a different party to the one that I was voting for.
I hope and you voted for the correct
one. I did. don't worry. The fact that I remember the fact I had to put a cross in what for me is the wrong box and post it.
Maybe I was just doing it to annoy you. Who knows?
You did know.
I've only ever voted once in the UK before I left, right?
Yeah.
And what I remember is it's actually a piece of paper, right? So you get a piece of paper and it has some names on one side and squares on the other, and you get given a little pen.
Yep.
And you go into a little like wooden booth with a curtain and you write a cross on the name. Is this all correct?
Yes. Yeah, you have to clearly mark. In fact, importantly, it's not a pen. I think it's a pencil because that's harder to delete or modify. If you go from the very beginning, you turn up. So actually, every I think year you have to make sure you're on the electoral register, get yourself on it. You can apply online or you can fill in a form they send to all your houses.
So they prompt you.
They prompt you, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And in fact they send it to you and you have to fill it in. So then they have that electoral roll. From the electoral roll, you can, if you want to on it, you can choose to have these postal votes, or if you don't, when you turn up in the polling station, they basically have a bit of paper which has all the people eligible in that area to vote. You go tell them you want to vote, they look you up, sign you off, and then they'll give you your little slip of paper with
your ballot
with all the names on, put your cross on it, and then you fold it up and drop it into the ballot box, which they keep secure.
So it's like a physical box. It's a physical box, paper and a physical box.
Yeah.
And
so no counting machines or anything like that.
I think this is, I think these kind of details, I think are actually really interesting, right? In terms of both how much you trust it and also like what are the mechanics of how these things take place? Because it's actually really different in different places. Mm-hmm. We've talked a little bit about the proxy votes and the mail-in votes, and it's like a physical piece of paper. When you said you have to go to a particular location is that assigned to you? Like,
yes,
you can only go to one location?
It's usually schools and church halls and things like that. You go in the countryside and sometimes it's a caravan that they have and they plonk on the side of a road in a car park.
Right, okay, yeah.
But yes, you're assigned a place. So when I did your proxy vote, it was based on where you used to live, which happens to be the other side of town.
Yeah.
So I had to get on my bike and cycle across to the... Literally the other side of town. It's a nice ride. I say that it was on the way to work. I had to deviate my way to work slightly to go and drop it off. But I had to go to the polling booth from where you used to live. Uh-huh. And if I vote in my one, it's the school around the corner.
Okay. And when you get there, are there like lines? Is it open at convenient times?
Yeah, I mean, they open about, I think, 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. They're open till 10 o'clock at night. So it's pretty convenient. Whenever I've been there, there's been 10 people and you're in and out within 5 minutes.
Okay, so it's pretty, like pretty convenient.
Yes. Oh, no. Yeah, it's really convenient. There's for a local one to me, the furthest I've ever had to go is 5 minutes around the corner.
Yeah. So it
I've always lived in towns, but within towns, it's within 5 minutes around the corner.
It doesn't sound like a big, palaver to actually do it. It's pretty easy, which of course is in comparison to the US, where it can be, you can be in line all day. Nikki, I'm going to ask you a question.
Go for it.
What's the basic organization of democracy in the UK? Tell us everything. No. We could start with talk us through the head of state and what the houses are of parliament and
right. I'm sure I'm going to get loads of this wrong.
But that's fine. Okay, so
head of state is our monarch, appointed by God, hereditary, etc., also head of the church.
Yes.
Lots of feelings about that we could explore later maybe.
Oh,
Then there are the two houses, so House of Parliament, House of Lords. House of Parliament, elected MPs. I feel like there's around 600-ish of them, but I might be completely off base on that.
Parliament, that was 600?
About 650.
Uh-huh. Someone's been doing its homework.
Each represent a constituency.
Okay, what's a constituency?
So a constituency is always geographically, demarcated area. I don't know if that varies at all in major cities, maybe. Mm-hmm. But so when I could still vote in the UK, I voted in the Canterbury constituency, which includes Canterbury, and then another smaller town, Whitstable, and then the kind of villages around it. I don't know quite how big in terms of square mileage there is, but, maybe within 10-mile radius, something like that. And again, I don't know how much that varies from place to place, big a constituency is, or even what the basis for determining a constituency is, if it's based on population or if it's just randomly historically generated. I don't know that at all.
So there's the House of Parliament and House of Lords. Tell us what the House of Lords is.
So, sorry, Houses of Commons is what I was just describing. House of Lords is... Okay, so here's where I get really confused. Because when I still lived in the UK, there was still a lot of hereditary lords, right?
Yeah.
But my understanding is most of those hereditary lords are no longer have their seats, right? There's a lot more appointed lords. Judges are in there? Religious leaders are in there. There's a bunch of church people in there, which again, lots of feelings about that one. So you got those two houses that constitute Parliament collectively, I think.
I think so, right? So you got the...
I get confused.
So, John, you look like you have opinions on this that you want to... Or facts on this that you want to interject. Tell us... About the Houses of Lords, John, are they still hereditary? Have we got bishops there? Are we correct in imagining that?
So it's when you said there's religious people in, it's specifically the
Church of England.
Certain Church of England bishops end up in it, but that means it's only Church of England bishops. Right. So there are now a few, I think, Muslim and Jewish religious leaders have been appointed, but you have to the government has to choose to get them in. Whereas the bishops just automatically come in. The hereditaries, it's about 100.
Oh, there are some left, yeah.
Yeah, there's still about 100.
I didn't realize there's that many still, yeah.
And then you have this very weird election when one of them retires or dies, the remaining hereditary peers vote the next one in. So there's the pool of people who used to be hereditary peers, and then whichever, from that pool, they choose the next one to replace the one who retires or dies.
That is, they actually have, like, you know, whole elections as well. You know, I mean, they're voting them in, but is there a whole, like, mini sort of internal, like, campaign going on?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a lot weirder than I imagined it would be.
I didn't realise this.
I think you might even have this weird thing that it has to be voted for by the people who are of a similar party as well. So it might even be a smaller pool, especially because a lot of them tended to be conservative. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask. So just to clarify there, even in the Houses of Lords, they have political parties.
Yes, yes. So, so within that, it depends. There's a fair amount with it are tied to a political party. You do get some called crossbenchers who sit as neutral candidates. So, I mean, it's been interesting over the last few years as the House of Lords has changed. Historically, they tend to be a lot more independent, but the House of Lords has really grown over the last few years as both Labour and the Conservatives have packed in lots of people, and they've packed in people who've recently retired from politics. It's become a lot more political, a lot more following party whip. The party line.
Nicola, I want to hear some of those opinions and those feelings you have, because is an unelected house that is a totally random group of people who just happen to be born in a particular family, is that better, more democratic than a group of ex-politicians who have been appointed by current members of the House of Parliament?
I don't think either is very democratic, you know. But then at the same time, I obviously live in a country with two elected houses or two elected chambers. And I have no faith whatsoever because of the process.
Right.
But that is democratic.
Yeah.
You know, because of the, if by democratic, we're thinking of sort of representative of the people's collective choice.
Yeah.
That is, I mean, it's not representative, you know, if a state with a million people gets the same number of senators as California with however many tens of millions of people it had, that's not, I don't think, very representative either. So I'm not sure any of it is very democratic if we're going to talk about, you know, at its essence, representing the collective wishes and choices. If I had to pick between one and the other, maybe I would be inclined to say that at least in theory, with the appointment, in theory, you get some turnover, right? That I don't think it's democratic, right? But at least X party is in control for a while and makes their appointments.
These appointments are for life.
Right. So. But, you know, I mean, compared to like, centuries and generations of the same family.
I see.
Yeah. Having that. So I don't know. I guess that would be the only way I would distinguish between them.
I'm getting the sense your opinion about something like the House of Lords has changed as a result of the seeing what's happening in the US. Would you maybe have been, if I'd have asked you this 20 years ago before you came to the US, I wonder if maybe you'd have said, yeah, it's totally undemocratic. But now it's like more ambiguity.
Yeah, I mean, I would still say it's totally undemocratic, but I would say that at the same time, the option that I live under here, which, you know, lauds itself as democracy around the globe, is far from it.
Right.
Also.
Yeah.
I think I'm just generally much more pessimistic about everything. No, I am not a believer in unappointed or unelected houses or unelected power, in the same way I'm not a fan of inherited power and position. I'm not sure this country has figured out the alternative to that.
Yeah.
You know, and there's still, even if it's not a formal generational power, you know, you have these families, right? Like the Kennedys, for instance, right? You still have families, and you still have families who, through their wealth and their power and their influence, it becomes this unacknowledged or informal generational power.
Yeah. So at least in the UK, it's called what it is.
Yes.
John, go ahead.
It's one of these things where I think until the last few years, the House of Lords was always really weird, but it worked. The problem you have at the moment is with the current government, because they are they ignore all the historic norms. The mm-hmm. whole UK constitution has always relied on the good chap principle, that the person yeah. in charge would be a good chap and he wouldn't put people who aren't very nice into the House of Lords. Yeah. Well, Boris Johnson isn't. So he's packed it for the cronies. And yeah. and you can see it, the work they do and the sort of people they go in there, they're not very good. They're as intelligent as the guys who are currently in the cabinet, which is not saying much. And you can see it in the quality of the debate and the quality of the the whole idea of that you'd have a good government and they would appoint people who are experts or really good in their field. Sounds a great idea until you get someone who doesn't care and so appoints Ian Botham, who's a famous cricketer mm-hmm. because he likes drinking red wine and he supported Brexit.
Ian Botham's a Lord now.
Yes, Ian Botham is now in the House of Lords.
He's a known exactly.
That's interesting because I think this sort of illustrates the difference between like how much we can keep on top of stuff when we're not there. Because like I would always have said, yes, the House of Lords and the Queen, for instance, it's not democratic in the sense of it's not elected, but it's sometimes people who are elected are not necessarily in the best interests, like as we see in the US, right? Sometimes you need, or it would seem desirable to have a group of people who are above politics and can make decisions based on what's sensible rather than having to worry about whether they'll be voted out or whether they'll have the political allegiance of Boris Johnson or whatever. So for me, I'd always felt like, okay, the House of Lords isn't great, but it serves as like a common sense backstop almost. Like if something gets passed that's obviously obscene, like sending refugees to Rwanda, then there's somebody who isn't beholden to the government of the day who can say, hang on, this is super racist and really impractical and just being populist politics pandering to the right wing. But the power to keep that going, like, and you're assuming that people are not going to use and abuse mm-hmm. that power.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem you see at the moment mm-hmm. with, and to be fair, the Lords still does do that. So the Lords still does much better scrutiny, mm-hmm. probably of a lot of these bits of legislation and holds them up and pushing. But again, that because there is no written constitution, that's getting pushed and broken in the same way that everything else is getting pushed and broken by Boris Johnson because he can get away with it.
Yeah. Well, tell me, because I just mentioned the Queen. The Queen is officially the head of state, and as Nicola, as you mentioned, the head of the church, which I think is something that's really interesting in the UK anyway. That mm-hmm. Like we talked about the bishops in the House of Lords. The church and state in the UK are explicitly constitutionally joined. Mm-hmm. But as we all know, in practice, they're kind of like, it's a little embarrassing to mention God too much kind of thing. But in terms of the Queen, how do you feel about, like, does the Queen actually have any power? What is the point of the Queen?
I still go back and forth on this. I mean, I think I sort of always had it ingrained in me that she was mostly just a figurehead. Mm-hmm. But then I think she does have more power than I realise, you know, in terms of being able to kind of like not let things happen if she really doesn't like them. And I'm sure there's lots more soft power that's wielded behind doors, or sometimes not even like completely behind doors, right? Charles has just come out against the Rwanda thing, right? And actually kudos to him for coming out against the Rwanda thing. I'm mostly pretty ambivalent about the royals. Like, I often wonder if this is a generational thing as well. Like, for the most part, I'm kind of indifferent.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not persuaded that they are, that all this money should be going their direction. But mostly there's just so much else that I'm enraged about around democracy all over the world, including the country in which I, you know, of which I'm a citizen. But at the moment, I'm finding it hard to be too upset about. Like, it's mostly like, whatever, it's just noise in the background, right? Yeah, which is different from when I was younger, when I was really like very much, okay, we should not have monarchy, it should end, etc. But I think it's just, in the same way, I was thinking about this when you said, Mary, about how like it's hard to keep on top of stuff and like to really know what's going on the ground. And I've been thinking about that a lot really like recently, because I felt like I've been more, you know, haven't been as following as closely. But I think that's also because it has been so exhausting to be in this political system, especially in this part of the country, in this political system right now.
Yeah.
That just like keeping my head above water following one system mm-hmm. has been hard, let alone following the other. So I think it's sort of like relative priorities in terms of what I'm mad about, you know?
But I'm interested in the fact that you said, in a sense, it's kind of an indifference, because for me, that kind of encapsulates the significance of having a monarchy.
Mm. That
I always say to people, I might define myself as an anarchist and a socialist, but I support having the queen, because having a queen means we don't have a president. We have somebody who's the head of state who officially has all the power, but actually doesn't have any. Because if she actually tried to exercise any of the power that she officially has, it would break the entire unwritten constitution. Mm-hmm. But that stops us having anybody else, like, who does actually wield power in the way the president does.
Mm-hmm.
And indifference in that sense is what you want, right? Do you want something that just exists in the background?
Mm.
But I've heard that argument from people before, but I think, again, it's quite a US-centric view to sit there and go, if you have a president, it has to be like the US president. You look at Italy, where effectively you have a elected president who mm-hmm. has the same sort of power as the Queen, but considerably cheaper, and actually there's some democratic accountability to it. Most countries that have a president is not like France and the US, mm. where it's a queen. You just call them the president, and they turn up in a nice suit and they open things and they can dissolve parliament. Mm-hmm. So they have the same powers. But also, when you say the queen doesn't have powers, it's the things like, I think it's in statute. So it was when they brought in, say, the Race Relations Act.
Mm.
The queen had an opt-out for herself because she could make it so she didn't have any black staff. And that's still in law, I think.
Oh.
if there's tax things that will impact them, they get them struck out.
Mm-hmm. But in a sense, I find it hard to get too incensed about the fact we have a monarchy, precisely because if it was like a presidency like we're talking about, where, again, it was somebody who officially had all the power but didn't actually exercise any power, I'd be fine with that too. But I find it hard to get too angry about the fact there's one particular family who has to occupy that role, partly because it seems so miserable. Like, you might be really rich, but like your whole
gilded cage.
You know the
reason you were born. Like, you don't have to ask, why was I born? You were born to be part of the apparatus state. The only purpose is to exist and have babies. Like, that's it. So shut up. Like, and you can't mm-hmm. also can't have opinions, right? Like, I think this is why we're getting a little off tangent, but this is why I think Prince Charles is kind of a problem, because like nobody knows what the Queen thinks. And that's perfect. Nobody knows what what's his name, the next one, Prince William, thinks. They just exist, they smile, they do their royal duties. They never express political opinions. They are a blank slate in that way, which I think is kind of the purpose of them, to be this thing that can exist in the background that you can be indifferent to, that is a complete blank slate.
Well, I don't think the Prince Charles thing, you mentioned, Nick, about the Rwanda, as much as I agree with him on what he said, he shouldn't have said it. He shouldn't have any opinions.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is where you get a little glimpse of why it would be, like you said, a gilded cage, because you have to live your entire life never mm-hmm. expressing an opinion, but being in the public eye.
Even me, as a pretty hardcore Republican, that's a small R Republican, not US big R Republican.
Yeah, yeah.
even as a pretty hardcore Republican, I know it's not going to happen. I know they're not going to get rid of. If you were to start your constitution, start your state from scratch, you wouldn't put the monarchy in place.
Yeah.
But it does kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to take a little pause here, but this is not the end of this conversation. Join us in episode 2 to get the other half of this conversation with Nicola and with John about democracy in the United Kingdom.